Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Telltale Heart, a Cardiovascular Digest for Pharmacists. And we are back again, kind of updating and covering the CCAM guidelines. I know last 2 weeks ago when they were fresh off the printing press, I provided a quick episode about my thoughts, but I wanted to bring some other perspectives on this and really get into the weeds of the guidelines and how they're going to be used, and maybe talk a little bit about some things from more recent data and where they think they'll go related to this. But definitely in the next several weeks, we are going to probably talk about several trials that have come out related to things like the fine CKD and
to reduce that data as well from that perspective. But today we're going to talk about the CKM guidelines. And of course, before we get into that, if you have things you want to hear about in the future, please let me know. Like, subscribe, you know, follow. Let us know what you are wanting to hear about, and rate us for the podcast from that standpoint. So as we jump in, I'm thrilled to have our guest today, and she is probably one of our first guests that we had on the podcast, and has. You know, we said when we had her on, we would catch up with her and see how things are unfolding with the transition she was making. And obviously, she's a huge leader in the cardio-kidney metabolic space. And so I'm happy to welcome back Lavinia. How are you doing today?
I'm doing excellent. And how are
you? Welcome. Welcome back. And I thought of you as soon as the CKM guidelines came out. I was like, who would I would like to hear from about what they're doing with this and how they're putting it in practice. And so here you are. Now, just to chronicle your journey, you were in Wyoming when we first talked to you, and you were planning to go to New York, but it sounds like you're back in Wyoming. Do you want to tell us what's been going on in your professional journey? And if I recall correctly, you loved Wyoming so much, not just from a practice standpoint, but I think it called you back, right? So
yeah, that's very true. I still do love Wyoming, and personally and professionally, I think it's a great state to grow in and practice as a pharmacist. As many of the pharmacists maybe listening know, that every state has different rules and regulations, and I did feel that part of being in New York, the laws and the regulation and the whole system that governs the collaborative practice agreement really limited my ability to practice on the top of my license.
Sure.
Which is something that really weighed out on me. And getting used to the city was already hard, but feeling that I can't practice the way I used to and do all of the amazing things that I have done for my patients here and take that back really made me feel like maybe this was not my home, and that I need to go back to the state where I grew 10 times faster in a short period of time. In addition to the personal side of it, Wyoming is really my home, and I didn't realize that till I actually left. And now that I'm back, I'm very excited.
It's a beautiful story. It's a beautiful story. So are you back at your same clinic? You were able to get back? Yeah.
Same clinic, team. Same university, same job.
No, that's awesome.
Just higher expectations, I think.
You know what? But aren't you glad you did it, and you were like, I tried something else, and just to validate, and
I am very thrilled.
Yeah, I mean, it's a part of life and a journey, and it's a great professional journey. And you had the ability and flexibility and all the things to do that. And I think it's a beautiful story that sometimes the place you're at is the right place for you. So
exactly. Yeah, I 100% agree.
Yeah, very good. Very good. That's awesome. Well, I'm glad that you're back. And so that actually made me even more excited to hear this when we were going to talk about the CKM guidelines. And so I guess for you, Lavinia, when you, I assume you've gotten to read and look into them since they've been published. Yes. Okay. Very good. What was your kind of initial reaction to the CKM guidelines and, you know, where they have gone or established since, you know, the 2023 scientific statement? What was your initial reaction, and what were the good things or things you're like, I really wish they would have talked more about this? Just kind of what were your high level assessment from that standpoint?
I think what was really exciting is what we had before was just a conceptual framework And now it had turned into a full-on formal recommendation by big associations like the American Diabetes Association and the American Society of Nephrology. And I think that makes it more of a formal guideline for us to take these recommendations more seriously. And instead of practicing things in silos like we used to in the past, now we're bringing all of these interdisciplinary avenues together, and we're putting it into a formal recommendation for us to use to care for our patients. And I do like that they put all of those conceptual evidence now into perspective for us to know, and the staging and the utilization of the PREVENT equation, which in the past we have. I am a big fan of the kidneys, and just personally struggled with my father with chronic kidney disease management. So knowing that now the new calculator that is recommended does incorporate the kidneys and albuminuria, which is a big marker of cardiovascular risk in the PREVENT equation, was something that I think is a huge shift, and it's going to help us prevent further complications to end-stage kidney disease and dialysis for our patient population. I am personally excited about all of the pharmacotherapy gap and the gap that they have identified. And they'll put recommendations into it, like the GLP-1 agonist therapy, because these in the past were viewed as obesity medications, other than diabetes, of course, but now they are formally recommended with class one recommendation in our patients with type 2 diabetes to slow down the progression of essentially everything that we have, like cardiovascular risk and chronic kidney disease. The way the CKM framework works is we start actually with early prevention, because prevention is better than cure. So it starts with preventing people from progressing to all of the complications that we're trying to prevent through tackling the obesity problem, because that's where it all starts. So I was very excited to see that it got a section, and it got the attention that it deserved to get in the in this new guidance, because it's if we really can prevent obesity or tackle it as soon as it happens, we can prevent all of those downstream effects that we are currently trying to prevent. Other than that, I'm losing my train of thought. Do you have
No, you're fine.
specific questions?
Well, yeah, I'll get you to some specific questions. I think what I liked, and I don't know how you're integrating this in the clinic, and I would love to hear as you think more through this. I think I was excited to see, for example, one of the big questions as we are going through this, and part of the process is how do we get, we're doing the American Heart Association implemented CKM program, right? And it's like, how do you balance out if 90% of patients fall into a CKM stage, stage one through four, and you only have so many limited resources and you're starting a program, how do you figure out who are you going to prioritize for treatment and therapy, right? From that standpoint. And so what I do like, and to your point about the PREVENT score, is, they say that, those, when you look at the CKM staging and inform that, those with a greater than 20% predicted 10-year risk, CVDD risk serving, it serves as one criteria for CKM stage three syndrome. So it gives you this framework. Okay, if they have a predict score that it gives them a greater than 20 percentile, that is, in that stage, those are your higher risk patients, which you normally could probably identify them, but it gives you a framework to at least start out with, like, here's a group we need to target. Because if you think stage four, those individuals are really secondary prevention. They already have disease. I'm not saying that they're not important, don't get me wrong, but you would work through them. But if you're really thinking about, if you're talking about people you need to really work through before they become those secondary eventers, if you will, what is that framework? And then, of course, they use that 7.5 threshold kind of across the other places to prioritize or inform pharmacotherapies for CKM, which is nice because that means that's consistent with like the hypertension guidelines and some of the other guidelines are in there, and there's really some uniformity around making sure that we're not having different thresholds of cut points for treatment for things. So I think that that was nice to kind of look and see in terms of when you think about implementation, what is that going to look like that? And then to your point, I think it's good that we have this call to arms around not just assessing our cardiovascular risk, assessing our renal risk. And even they had the call out, and we've alluded to this, and it's gaining traction, especially because the Survodutide data that, adults with CKM and diabetes or two cardiometabolic risk factors, they should also get a FIB4 screening every 1 to 2 years, thinking about that MASH, MASL type construct that needs to be included in there. And that wasn't originally in the 2023. So we are kind of being a little bit more
As
comprehensive
well
in
as
thinking about.
obstructive sleep apnea, too. It was just
Correct.
mentioned in the CKM, and now they include it as a formal annual symptom recommendation screening every year
Right.
for
Yeah,
patients
for
with
sure.
obesity.
And so, I think, have you already been thinking about that? Has in your collaborative practice agreements, things that you're adding to adjust and like, oh, I need to be thinking about what this is going to do and if we're going to screen these and who's going to manage that piece in that process. Have you already been modifying or working on changing your agreements for that? And remind me again, can we pause for a second? How does Wyoming's collaborative practice agreements work? What is that? I don't know if we talked about that
I don't think we
the last.
have. So right now we're working through getting our provider status. So there's a lot of exciting things in the state of Wyoming, but I honestly don't know. That is all being in the works, and we're advocating for it. But our collaborative practice agreement, basically, that I have with the physicians is that I can manage any disease state that's in the agreement independently. I can formally prescribe, and I could list them as a co-signer, but I could essentially prescribe on my own, do everything on my own, as long as it's anything included in our collaborative practice agreement.
Okay.
So right now, I am working back to my collaborative practice, and I'm reusing the old one that I have, and I am adding more things into it, like the obstructive sleep apnea, because now we have a medication that's approved for it, which is Zepbound. But I also would like to add the screening so that I could send referrals without having to go back to them and asking them to send it. Anything that wasn't in the agreement before, I would have to go back to any of the physician that was available, any of the attendings, and ask them to, hey, it wasn't in the agreement, but I really want this patient to get screened for obstructive sleep apnea. Can you please send the referral? But if I add it, that really saves that extra step that I have to go to them and ask them to do it.
Sure. Very good. And so I think that to your point, and I'm so glad you called out the obstructive sleep apnea piece because that's important. And of course, as you're aware, or as people are aware, a lot of the therapies that are we're using in your CKM tie into this and tie into the extension because if you talk about GLP-1s, they have, one of them has a labeled indication for obstructive sleep apnea and that you can work through and kind of work through that. And to your point, that's one of the big call outs they do is that we really are getting this routine assessment of metabolic risk factors and checking kidney function. So have you guys in your clinic's been maybe more prolific at this, have you guys started really drilling down in either finding patients who haven't had those things done yet, or are you really starting to do this more routinely as patients are coming in? Is it doing that more standard your analysis, which I know you had said, I think previously, and I think this is still the case. A lot of your patients were diabetic patients. Is that correct? Yeah.
Yes.
And so you would be already routinely screening UACR and eGFR, and you've been doing both, right?
Yes, always. Since I started back in 2022 in this clinic, I've always been doing urine albumin to creatinine ratio screenings, and I am continuing to do so. Sometimes it gets missed, but all of the questions that you're asking me, I just met with some of the clinic leaders today, and I asked them those very same questions. Are we missing them? Do we need to add urine albumin to creatinine ratio as part of the protocol, or like if someone gets in for diabetes screening, should we just be adding it to routine labs to be screened for? And there are some talks in my clinic about how to screen for obstructive sleep apnea, but as of now, we're not. This is my first day,
Yeah.
so
First day
again,
back. Wow.
yes,
Look at you.
I just got back to the clinic. As for obstructive sleep apnea, as far as I know, we're not doing anything to look back and see who we missed the screenings, but this is certainly an amazing project for myself and my students, like as a quality improvement project to see who needs to be screened that we have not screened for yet. But as for the kidney disease screening, I've always done it and it will be continued.
Very good. And can I ask this question? Have you, and maybe because you're just getting back, you haven't thought about, they do have the specific call out of, it's a 2A recommendation, but the process of, running a prevent score, but you know how the prevent has the three components, the ASCVD and the, but then they have the heart failure piece, right? And then, if they have a prevent score that's a greater than 5% for heart failure, they suggest evaluating pre-heart failure biomarkers like BNP or NT-proBNP or cardiac troponins and doing that. Is that something you guys are thinking about as well or considering as a part of the process?
Yes, it's definitely something that I am considering because when I was in New York, I actually worked under I worked in collaboration with an endocrinologist, and he would do the NT pro BNP for our patients. So I do want to continue to practice at the top of my license, and I want to make sure that patients get screened for all essentially all the comorbidities that we're trying to prevent. So we make sure we put them on the appropriate medications as early as possible, and we know if there's any damages or any structural changes to their heart that we need to be aware of, and they need to be aware of because maybe sometimes that helps people take things more seriously when they know how far their disease state really has progressed from maybe just a mild A1C increase, or simple hypertension.
Yeah, very good. And which I know you had alluded this on your last talk, but one of the other major points and always has been in the construct of CKM guidelines has been social determinants of health assessment. The social determinant of health screening, is there, which I guess is day one since you've been back, so I don't know, is there something that, Wyoming has a different degree of sets of social determinants with geography and those type of things. Is there anything that you've thought of coming back or since you've left and come back you need to think through? Or were you guys already doing pretty aggressive social determinants of health screening as a part of your clinic?
So, this is definitely something I also appreciate in the new guidance is now it provides like we need to annually and formally be routinely screening for social determinants of health. I have two amazing social workers that I work with here, and they are still here. It's very fortunate. And we do screen our patients. We have a questionnaire, and we do screen for, especially for my end, to what I look for are food insecurities as it pertains to majority of my patients, especially when they are placed on insulin or therapies for type 2 diabetes, because it certainly impacts what how I would like to modify their therapies. Any financial strains, and if they have inability to afford, particularly of course the life-saving medications, our social workers help with all of the patient assistance programs from the company. And I always value building good relationships and bonds with the pharmaceutical reps because they often have insights as to how we can get certain medications covered or which insurances would cover certain medications so I could talk to my patients about some of those. And then housing instability matters a lot for my clinic and my patients also, because where are they going to store their GLP-1 agonist, or where are they going to store their insulin if they don't even have a stable home? So all of these things we do screen for as soon as they get to our clinic, but we have not been routinely rescreening for them as they progress. I personally ask my patients questions as it pertains to what I am managing them for. I always assess for food. I always assess for transportation challenges and financial constraints almost at every visit. But formally, I don't think we do that every
We do
single.
that. So it's something you're kind of working through or going to put in
Yes.
there. Very, very good. And so obviously since you're you have mostly a primary diabetic diabetic population, let's move a little bit into the treatment with pharmacotherapy. What Not that anything was necessarily a surprise per se, and maybe the better question is when you think about alignment with other guidelines or something to that effect, what is your thoughts about, the cardioprotective agents or anti-hyperglycemic agents with cardioprotective benefit and the kind of those recommendations? Anything surprising to you? Things that you like, this is great, this is what we should be doing, it aligns with everything. What were your overall thoughts and feelings related to that
Think it
process?
was surprising because I've seen how like the influx of data has been coming through the past couple of years. So it wasn't surprising to see that they are integrated in every single guideline now, from the cardiology guidelines, diabetes guidelines, and now officially in the CKM guidelines. I do use them, and I think everyone should be on them. I think the main limitation is cost for a lot of my patient population. But I do believe like the GLP-1 agonist and SGLT2 inhibitors have changed the way we care for our patient population and how we prevent all of these comorbidities from even happening in the first place. So not really surprised, just glad to see that they continue to be reinforced in every single guideline, and excited about the future because none of these medications are really benign. And the way we care for our patients, they all come with risks, they all come with side effects. And so I think it is our responsibility to counsel our patients on how to use these medications appropriately and side effects to watch out for. And I still believe that lifestyle management is the
Yeah,
cornerstone.
I was gonna. Yeah, you got to say that. And like of the things that are, and there's a decent amount of class one recommendations in this set of guidelines, right? Of course, in any of them, whether it be treating kidney disease, whether it's treating diabetes, whether it's treating cardiovascular risk, they do obviously remind people that lifestyle modification, healthy diet, physical activity, and level are all important and adjunctive to this whole process and need to be done from that standpoint. But then, with the stages 2 to 3, this multifactorial intervention process that is lifestyle changes, in pharmacotherapy that address all the comorbidities, both hyperglycemia, hypertension, dyslipidemia, now bupropion, indicated. So that includes the extension of those arms, GLP-1s, SGLT2s, non-steroidal and mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists, which I think got a pretty strong call out from that standpoint. But then they do tie into the patients that that have that 7.5% prevent score. Their plan should include an SGLT2 or a GLP-1 based on the benefits that you're alluding to, like all the data that has come out from that particular standpoint. And it's nice because, as you were already talking about, in the decreasing the salivation, those really also benefit cardiovascular outcomes and kidney outcomes, and we know that it's important from that standpoint. So it's nice to have that kind of overlapping thought process from that standpoint.
Yeah, I guess my biggest question was, which I think is still a care gap that we're currently identifying, is a lot of the questions that I used to get is, we have a patient with resistant hypertension, but also chronic kidney disease with significant albuminuria. Do we prioritize giving them finerenone, or do we prioritize fixing the hypertension with like an MRA, which we know they have data to show that they can decrease albuminuria. But we don't necessarily have data to show that they can slow down the progression of chronic kidney disease in the same way we have finerenone to do such. So I think that is definitely a care gap that I'm hoping.
Well, and that may change, especially with the ASIs that
Yeah,
have
the
gotten
aldosterone
approved, the
synthase
aldosterone
inhibitor.
synthase
Yeah.
inhibitors, and where they are going to look, because I know they will have
Yes.
renal outcomes at some particular juncture. I think
Yeah,
the
the
thing is
ECKidney is being currently enrolling patients, and I'm very excited to see what this data will show.
yeah.
And especially in the non-diabetes patient population.
Yeah, well, I think in today's domain, to your point, I think, thinking about the kidney and the risk, I think you can argumentatively say, still sticking with finerenone as being the choice and working through your other options from managing hypertension if you still have a treatment resistance, and thinking about it from that particular standpoint. It is interesting. There's lots of articles that have been coming out recently about, and this has been in existence with ASIs, like, oh, do you test for, auto levels, and what does that look like, and what does that mean, especially in the resistant folks, and even with those with resistance, depending on the level, maybe finerenone may have some different type of effect or piece of that process. So I think, to your point, I think there's some strategies to do that and maintain. I think the other thing is obviously the good old things that we continue to do and keep make sure people are on and titrating and are on ASARBs, ARNIs,
Exactly.
if they have that heart failure risk, from that standpoint. So I think that there is things there, but you're right, it is a care gap. But I think there are opportunities and ways to work through that piece and that process. So, very good. So, have you changed your strategy? You mentioned UACR and EGFR and those things. Have you guys thought about it? Are you going to change your strategy, or were you already doing the most optimal thing in terms of managing the patients that have that elevated UACR level, for example, or albuminuria? What is your take on the guidelines here, and what are you going to do or change from that standpoint?
I honestly think I was very fortunate to have an excellent residency that was very much focused on, I mean, majority of my time was spent in patients with CKD and dialysis. So I had a lot of exposure before establishing my own practice when I even started in the very beginning that I do need to maximize the ACEs and the ARBs first. And around the time I finished my residency, finerenone was actually gaining a lot of popularity and the trials were just published. So the way I always practiced is the way this guideline is written. So I really think it was because I got a lot of kidney training, which I was very fortunate because at that time I was hearing that not it's like nationally we're not doing a very good job teaching chronic kidney disease or kidney disease on a national level across the United States. So it's not going to make me necessarily change my practice because my practice has always been do the ACEs and ARBs, then the SGLT2 inhibitors, and then finerenone if still indicated. So this just reinforces, and now I'm very excited about, like you said, the aldosterone synthase inhibitor data. And once that comes out, we'll see if I need to shift the way I practice
You're
and who
waiting
would get,
anxiously.
yes. And who would get which particular therapy? But as of now, I don't think this will change my practice.
So what other things that you really appreciated or got a call out from the CKM guidelines, or that you were like, ah, this is great?
I think I really appreciate the assessing and treating overweight and obesity as early as we can and targeting that at least 5 to 10% weight loss via lifestyle modification. And I always tell people that I spend majority of my visit talking to patients about lifestyle changes and maybe 10 minutes talking about medications and side effects because I still believe that the cornerstone of how all of this started is likely lifestyle habits changes. Of course, there's other risk factors, but I think food, our relationship with food and exercise are things that need to be tackled, especially as we are starting all of these highly beneficial agents. And all of the clinical trials really use lifestyle changes in adjunct with all of the life-saving medications. So I do love the emphasis on how much weight should we target with our lifestyle modifications, and that we need to start thinking about obesity in terms of preventing all of the downstream side effects. It's not just cosmetic. And now we have medications that can target 15 to 20%, which is almost equivalent to bariatric surgery. And we have some that are in the works that are even better than
It would
bariatric
be even better than
surgery.
that, right?
Yes.
Lilly's new agent, right? Had the
Yes.
headline. I think I talked about that a couple of weeks ago. Very good. So, the one other thing that I did appreciate in the last thing, and I don't know if there's stuff that you picked up, but there's definitely lots of opportunity for still questions to be answered and research to be done. What does the interdisciplinary care team model look like? What are the combinations of therapies? How do we work through polypharmacy or adding these therapies from that standpoint? You mentioned on the flip side, can steroid MRAs replicate finerenone benefits? And so far, we haven't seen that. What does the education infrastructure look like? Billing and reimbursement. How do we work through the heart failure prevention? Of course, as we continue learning about MACE and MASL, what is that going to look like as it gets into the CKM standpoint and the weight? And we'll have trials to answer those questions as well from that standpoint. Any other gaps or things you thought were interesting or you think about?
Yeah, I definitely think the interdisciplinary care, like who's really going to manage such medications, because now that we have all of that overlap, like an endocrinologist, a nephrologist, or a
Right.
primary care can start an SGLT2 inhibitor or a GLP-1 agonist. Who's going to be responsible for titrating the doses? Who's going to be responsible for monitoring, or counseling the patients when something, when like, you know, severe consequences happen, like euglycemic DKA, et cetera. So I do think having a care coordinator would be very beneficial, CKM
Yeah.
care coordinator, but then who's going to take the initiative to establish that? So I think the more people work through CKM-based clinics and the more they publish, the more we all learn from each other, and then hopefully we all can start integrating things more effectively. But yeah, I still believe it's a care gap, and how are we going to get these medications covered is another care gap for a lot of our
Right.
patient population. Because it's great that we have the data, but then what are we going to do with those who seriously cannot afford anything?
Sure. No, always important for sure. So, any final thoughts from the CKM guidelines from your perspective?
I think it's I'm very glad to see it being written an official recommendation,
Yeah,
like
an official guideline document, right?
yes, an official guidance, an official document, and I'm just excited for the future of this and to see what I can do personally in my clinic. I have a lot of ideas, and I am already thinking about billing and how I can bill for my services, and thinking about how to collaborate with our one endocrinologist that's in town and our cardiologist, to hopefully maybe we could be the CKM coordinator, and because it's a
And
primary
that's what, really,
in our
we're
town.
trying to do is get the pharma. So I love that. I love
Yes,
that.
I think the pharmacists are very well positioned to be one of the coordinator, a care coordinator, actually. I mean, we could manage it all, and we're the medication experts. So I think we're very well positioned to be a CKM care coordinator if you wanted to be.
Absolutely. I 100% agree with you. I think pharmacists are hardly well positioned to be in that
Yes.
role and to be leading this through.
Yes,
Lavinia, it is. Go ahead. Go ahead. Please. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was talking to
Continue.
our clinic coordinator today, and she said you're very highly ambitious for someone who just hasn't even unpacked. And I was like, yes.
Yeah,
For
that ambition is good,
love.
right?
Yes.
You're out there climbing mountains and doing all the
Yes.
things. So, and that's why you're back in Wyoming.
Yep.
All right,
Climb the
Lavinia, it's been
mountain.
great to have you again and catch up and hear your journey, both from a professional and personal and practice standpoint, and to hear your thoughts on the CKM guidelines. So I appreciate you taking the time. And for
Thank you
everybody
so much
else,
for
please
having
thank you
me.
for joining us and listen. And please, we hope you join and listen next week as we delve into some of the clinical trials that have been coming out at ADA and some of the other things from that standpoint. And we will catch you soon. So thank you all again. Like, subscribe, share, post, rate. Let us know what we can do to continue to make this podcast meaningful and important to you all. So thank you all for taking the time and joining us. Goodbye.